This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. The years of Donald Trump's presidency reached their end, their absolute nadir, last week. On Wednesday, the president went to the Ellipse between the White House and the National Mall, and he delivered an incendiary speech to his followers. For the better part of an hour, he spun his conspiratorial fantasies, rigged voting machines, phantom ballots, speaking to people who had already bought into an unending barrage of lies about the election, what he called the stolen election. Then he urged the crowd to march to the Capitol, where the Congress would be voting to certify the electoral results. And his intent was clear: to block Joe Biden's official ascent and overturn an American election. "March to the Capitol," Donald Trump told them, "and I will be there with you." Of course, they marched, and he went home. And he watched what he had incited on television: the whole ugly insurrection, an assault on American democracy incited by an American president. Blood was shed in the Capitol building and on its grounds. And finally, even his most sycophantic followers knew it was over. The Trump era was over, and they needed to make their excuses. It's hard to admit, but Donald Trump, despite all his ugliness, his racism, his mendacity, his disdain for the rule of law and democratic values, despite all of that, had it not been for the pandemic, he may well have won re-election. The pandemic and his colossal mishandling of it undid him at the polls. And on the day of his bloody insurrection, almost 4,000 Americans died. Not at the Capitol, but of COVID-19, our worst single-day death toll. For 7 months, staff writer Lawrence Wright has been at work reporting on the pandemic, the failure of leadership, and some of the miracles along the way. We published Larry's work in The New Yorker at some 30,000 words, and the piece is called The Plague Year. Larry, hi, how are you?
It's a pleasure to talk to you, David.
So much has been written and said about the pandemic, and there'll be much more to come inevitably, but what did you set out to do?
From the beginning, David, I had this idea that this pandemic is not just about illness, it's not just about health. It's about our society and how it's changed in the face of this onslaught. And, you know, it's touched on race relations, the economy, our politics, and of course, science. And I wanted to find a way to thread a needle through all of those aspects of our society and see how we've changed as a country.
So as of a few days ago, the United States was experiencing 200,000 new cases of COVID per day. The virus has already killed over 300,000 people. If one's going to start assigning blame for this enormous disaster, where would you start?
Well, it's a political failing to start with. I mean, public health, you know, there was a global preparedness index that was prepared that came out in October of 2019, looking at countries all over the world to determine how well prepared are they for a pandemic. And the answer was they were not very well prepared, but the country that was most prepared in the whole world was the United States.
So what the hell happened? If we were the most prepared of any country in the world, it turns out we've had the we have to be somewhere at the bottom of the reality.
We are. You know, the magnitude of our failure is unparalleled in the whole world. So what happened? There were several things, and there's fault to be thrown in different directions. And let me start with public health. There were assumptions in the public health world that turned out to be wrong. One is that travel bans don't work. Well, actually, you know, they can be very useful in slowing the transmission. And countries that enforced travel bans early, followed by quarantines, such as Taiwan or New Zealand, they actually did pretty well in this pandemic. We eventually had our own travel bans, and they, especially the first one against China, they probably did buy us some time, but we didn't use it very wisely. And masks, you know, there's another thing, you know, in the public health world, you may well remember the tweet by our Surgeon General, you know, seriously, people, don't buy masks. They don't work. You know, that was the message the public health contingent was giving out, and it turns out that masks are crucial.
How could they have been so wrong about something so elemental?
They were basing their whole presumption on flu. Flu, you know, you can wear a mask if you have the flu, and it might keep people away around you from getting it. But essentially, it's not seen as a real barrier against the transmission of disease. And SARS-1, you know, it only transmitted when people were actually sick. So it just wasn't seen as being that important. But to tell you the truth, David, you know, masks have been a question mark in public health. And now I think that question mark has been removed.
The president of the United States famously mocked the use of masks. He did seemingly everything he could to discourage the wearing of masks, including at White House ceremonies that became super spreader events. This is a terrible question to have to ask. But do you lay at the feet of the President of the United States many, many deaths? It seems inevitable.
Oh, I do. I think you can't help but look at them. You know, let's give him credit where it belongs. I think that Operation Warp Speed may turn out to be, you know, the best thing that the Trump administration was able to do to bring these vaccines online much quicker than they have been in the past. Aside from that,
but what did the administration actually do in terms of warp speed? What was its action other than to call for having a vaccine as quickly as possible?
The big change, David, was that they offered to pay for the vaccines even if they failed, so that Big Pharma would have an incentive to get in and start developing these vaccines right away. And also they partnered. And, you know, it's been a tremendously successful so far development of a vaccine, world record-breaking time. But these companies knew they weren't going to lose money. Pfizer did not buy into the warp speed, but they had a guarantee from the government to buy millions of doses. And Moderna did buy into it, and so has Johnson & Johnson and several others. It has accelerated the process of vaccine development enormously. 4 years was the previous record for a vaccine to go from development into the arms of Americans.
But if that's the case, and it certainly seems to be the case, why was the President of the United States so cynical about, dismissive of masks and so much else?
Well, you know, it's a psychological problem as far as I can tell, David, honestly. He agreed that this might be useful. He said that some people think it's useful, and it might be. But then he went on to say, but I'm not going to wear it. It's voluntary, and I'm not going to wear it. And in that case, he became a kind of saboteur. He undermined the policy of public health that his advisors were pushing. And he commands the attention of millions and millions of Americans. There's one other thing that I would lay at his feet. Is, you know, our response never had a national plan. There was a telephone call that the president had with the governors. And he said, we're behind you. But to clarify that, as for PPE and that sort of stuff, you get it yourself.
You're on your own.
And they had no idea this was going to happen to them. And nor were they prepared. I mean, Gretchen Whitmer, the governor of Michigan, told me that they only had enough PPE for one more shift. I mean, they don't have a national stockpile. And, you know, the president had complained that the stockpile was empty when his administration came into office, which it was depleted. It had been depleted by the previous pandemic in 2009. But in 3.5 years, the Trump administration had done nothing to augment that supply. So, you know, we were low on supplies nationally. But then when the governors go out on the market to try to find masks, gloves, gowns, all, you know, thermometers, everything that they need to fight in this pandemic, they find themselves bidding against each other. And then finally, they find themselves bidding against the United States, the federal government, which in many cases would seize the shipments that the states had ordered and confiscate it for federal use. Charlie Baker, the governor of Massachusetts, ordered a couple of million from China, and it came into the port of New York, and FEMA seized it and paid a little bit more for them. And the next time he ordered masks, he did it secretly. He got the owner of the New England Patriots to send the team plane to China, and then they flew it into Logan Airport and loaded it into trucks with the National Guard. And that was the case of many governors around our country.
Now, Peter Hessler, our correspondent in China, painted a portrait of a country that did a much better job of containing the virus once it was out and about and doing its damage. But what could China have done to stop this much earlier? What responsibility is on the Chinese government for its lack of transparency about what was happening in Wuhan?
Well, China's behavior, David, is really sinister, in my opinion. You know, in 2003, there was the SARS outbreak. And in that case, the Chinese government actually hid the infected patients from World Health Organization authorities. They put them in ambulances and checked them into hotels until the authorities were gone, even as SARS was spreading around, you know, all over the world. This time, in late December, Chinese scientists began to realize that there was an unknown pneumonia circulating and that people were dying of it. And immediately, they became worried that it might be SARS. Doctors figured this out. They actually had patients tested and it came back as a SARS-like virus. And that information was suppressed. And eventually, the Chinese government posted the genome of the new virus online January 10th. To this day, as far as I understand, they haven't given any patient samples, and that delayed the development of the test. I mean, there are many other examples I could give you, but Chinese behavior in this, in terms of caring for what's happening in the rest of the world outside of their own country, has been disgraceful, in my opinion.
I'm talking with The New Yorker's Lawrence Wright. And in a moment, we'll hear about a government playbook on how to respond to a pandemic and just what the Trump administration did with it. It's the New Yorker Radio Hour. More to come. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. I'm talking today with Lawrence Wright, a longtime staff writer for the New Yorker. And his article, The Plague Year, is an epic account of how the United States responded to the COVID-19 pandemic. To what extent was the federal response in the United States by the book, as they say, and how much of it was ad-libbed?
Well, you know, when the Obama administration turned over documents to the incoming Trump administration, among them was this playbook for a pandemic. And it lays out very clearly, what should be done in the case of an outbreak like this. And, you know, federal plan, for instance, you know, what would that look like? And a whole list of all the government agencies for a brand new administration that's not used to the scope of the federal government. Who do you call and what will they do for you? And the Trump administration just jettisoned that, and they created their own. They had a crimson contagion exercise that went on for part of a year. And they learned quite a lot about how would they behave in case of such a pandemic. And the answer was it would be chaotic. Government agencies wouldn't know which one was in charge. There was not enough PPE available. And all of the things that actually did happen were forecast in the Trump administration's own exercise.
Were they distracted by the impeachment drama early on in the in the pandemic?
Yeah, I think there, you know, one could say that the president was distracted. But if you go back in January, when the impeachment trials began, it's, I think, on January 23rd that the first mention of the coronavirus is uttered in the Congress. Mitch McConnell says that there'll be a briefing the next day about the new virus. And about 20 senators showed up. And the public health authorities, including Redfield and Fauci, were pretty casual about it. There were no, you know, there was no incidence of transmission in the United States so far. It always seemed to be over the horizon. Some people were aware. You know, I mean, we, you know, you should point out that there were people that knew that this was going to be a real problem.
Well, one of the people that you describe in great detail, and he's kind of a profile within the bigger story, is a national security official named Matt Pottinger, a former journalist from the Wall Street Journal, whose specialty was China. And the portrait you create of him, that you paint of him, is of somebody who knows damn well what's going on and who's trying his best, but is existing in a White House funhouse of, it's like a bad dream. And he can't get anywhere. Describe his interactions with the president.
Well, you know, first of all, I have to say, Matt is a former reporter. And it turns out that that's a really valuable background to have when you're not wed to any of these orthodoxies of public health, for instance. You're not stuck in some sort of policy world. You are just looking at the problem. And, you know, when the outbreak first arose, he remembered his experience in China during the SARS outbreak. And so he started calling his sources in China and Hong Kong and Taiwan and speaking to some of the doctors that he had spoken to before. And they gave him a totally different picture than the one the Chinese government was propagating. And he got really worried. And so he began what became the Coronavirus Task Force. He's summoned people from different agencies. He's the deputy national security advisor. So they all have representatives, but he'd often bring in cabinet members and try to spur them into taking this seriously. And eventually, the first action that drew Trump into it was that Matt believed that we had to stop flights from China. There were direct flights coming in every day, even from Wuhan. Directly into thousands and thousands of Chinese tourists and Americans who had been in China were coming into the United States every week. And it occurred to Matt, we should stop this. And, you know, this is one of the things that public health people were resistant to, because the idea in public health had always been, well, you need to be able to move doctors and equipment around. Probably the disease has already gotten here, so travel bans are ineffective. It stigmatizes the country where the disease is. There were a lot of reasons. But the other thing that weighed against that was, look, we're bringing in thousands of potentially infected people into our country. And, you know, we need to slow that. And Matt advocated very strongly for that and then took that to the president. He eventually had support from the public health people, that Fauci and others, to stop travel from China. And
but Pottinger must have been incredibly frustrated by Trump's behavior overall, no?
Yeah, I think he talks to me at the end about leadership. And, you know, he thinks that there are things that the president got right, like the travel ban, that he's seldom given credit for. And I think warp speed. On the other hand, Matt was the first person to wear a mask in the White House. And he said it was like wearing a clown nose. People couldn't believe he was doing it. And the president said, "Are you sick?" And he said, "No, I just don't want to go down in the history books as the guy that knocked off the president with COVID." And, you know, he then thought, you know, "I'll give masks to everybody in the National Security Council." But it turned out the White House didn't really have any masks. And it was very difficult to find them at that point. So he put in a call to Taiwan, and that Taiwan was at that point making 11 million masks every day for their 23 million citizens. And they donated several million masks, and Matt appropriated some masks for the White House.
Both Anthony Fauci and Deborah Birx are portrayed in this piece at some length. Anthony Fauci is often portrayed in almost saintly terms. I mean, he's become a kind of cult figure, but his determinations were not always perfect. Deborah Birx's reputation was much more mixed, and yet we get a picture of her that's quite interesting here. How did you come away from your reporting analyzing Anthony Fauci and Birx?
You know, I admire them both. You know, and Dr. Fauci, as you point out, has been kind of canonized, but he was also a representative of certain public health orthodoxies that he had to change. And one thing that, you know, this experience has taught us, science is a process of learning from your mistakes. It was hard for people like Dr. Fauci to go back and undo ambivalent statements at the beginning of this outbreak and come down so firmly, for instance, on the subject of masks. But that's what science is. Birx, it's interesting, early on when I was doing my reporting, I was getting a lot of derogatory comments about her from people in public health. And part of it was they couldn't stand the fact that she seemed to be kowtowing to Donald Trump. And yet, you know, she was able to stay in the White House and be influential by at least, you know, accommodating what he said in public and then talking differently in private. It wasn't until this Dr. Scott Atlas came on board, a radiologist who was a Fox commentator, and he caught Trump's ear. And, you know, he was advocating herd immunity and totally contrary ideas to what responsible people in public health were saying.
Advocating herd immunity is essentially throwing up your hands and saying, well, let's let everybody get it until it burns itself out. But in the meantime, hundreds of thousands more people would have died.
Exactly. Well, his idea was, let's let them get infected. That's how you create herd immunity. But it didn't seem to matter so much that there'd be hundreds of thousands of more casualties than there would be if we actually fought against the disease as other responsible societies had accomplished.
But at that point, how do you not throw up your hands and think the government is not only making mistakes, but is in the hands of people who are giving insane advice?
Well, you know, there were influential people involved in this government that really, really did a lot of damage. And, you know, there was Michael Caputo, for instance, who was the spokesperson for the Health and Human Services Department, which oversees, by the way, the CDC, the NIH, and FDA. So he's the chief spokesperson for all of this. And what kind of priorities did he have? Well, one thing was they were going to do a public service announcement. They wanted to get celebrities to advertise what a great job the president is doing. And to accomplish this, he took $300 million out of the CDC budget. This is a guy who is Roger Stone's best friend, who had been in Russia working for Gazprom, and one of his tasks was to polish Vladimir Putin's image. How such people find their way into this administration is just a mystery to me, but they actually affect policy. They direct our policy.
One of the big questions that's going to face the Biden administration is how to roll out the vaccine and treatments to the communities that need them the most. What's the current thinking about how to distribute the vaccine properly and the politics of that?
You know, this is an opportunity for the Biden administration to create what we haven't had up to this point, which is a national plan. You know, it would be so helpful if we had federal guidance, not just for the inoculations, but we haven't finished with this disease yet. You know, it's still spreading. and cresting. And it probably will be like that when the Biden administration comes into office. We'll be just finishing with the holidays. I foresee it being kind of a nightmare. And we need to have a firm guiding principle at the top of this so that the states are united and not at war with each other over purchasing supplies, that we have a national mask mandate, for instance, in order to try to get this under control. These are things that the Trump administration has been reluctant to do.
Larry, do you think the pandemic has fundamentally altered the political landscape in the country, and in what way?
Oh, I think that the political fallout for this is going to be enduring. And part of it has to do with how does the government relate to people? I mean, I think this is, you know, I analyze this as this pandemic as being like an X-ray that allows us to see all the broken places in our society. One of the things that's broken is the trust between the government and the people. And, you know, this pandemic has laid bare how the lack of compassion, the lack of competence in our federal government. And those are things that have to be mended in order for people to regain the kind of trust that a healthy society needs to have.
You can read Lawrence Wright's The Plague Year at NewYorker.com. Now, even as we were putting the finishing touches on Larry's article, more and more questions were circulating about a new virus, or rather, a new strain, a new variant of the coronavirus. Carolyn Cormon, who covers science for us, put some of those questions to one of the specialists who is looking at the new strain, Joseph Osmundson, a molecular biologist at New York University. Osmundson studies DNA replication, and he's written extensively about COVID-19.
I wanted to talk about some of the stuff we're seeing in the news, and we're now dealing with not just one, but two strains of the original coronavirus we know so well. And these strains are distinct. Could you break down for me on a really kind of granular level, how often does this virus, SARS-CoV-2, mutate?
You know, biology is never perfect. And so everything is going to make mistakes. Your cell sometimes makes mistakes when it copies all of its DNA. A virus will inevitably mutate. And those mutations are, so we call them the raw material of evolution, right? So if there are differences in the genetic sequence of a virus, those differences can have phenotypic differences, which just means differences in how the virus acts. Does it, you know, replicate faster? Does it replicate more in certain cells? You know, and the more transmission that occurs, the more people the virus is in, the more chances it has to change. Right. So this is yet again a reason why, you know, the NPIs, the non-pharmaceutical interventions, social distancing is so important. This virus is worrisome. I will say that it is for sure worrisome, in part because of the number of mutations it has. It has 23 total mutations.
That's a surprise to scientists.
It is. And we actually, the leading hypothesis of how the virus may have emerged, we know that, you know, most people, an individual gets COVID, they spend a couple days not yet feeling sick, but they're infectious, then they may shed virus for another 8 to 10 days after that. And then, you know, it's an RNA virus. It doesn't stick around in your body. Even if you're testing positive after that 10 days, we think the vast majority of people, the virus is not actively replicating and they're not infectious. But we know for sure that people with compromised immune systems can actually replicate the virus for a much longer period of time, right? So up to 70 days. So one infection, an individual has shed virus for 70 days if they're immunocompromised. And that is actually that person's immune system over a long period of time putting a lot of pressure on the virus to mutate, right? So that's the type of situation we think where these strains with so many mutations in them may evolve. It's kind of an atypical infection in an individual.
Wow. So you're saying that the variant with 23 mutations most likely came from a person. It evolved in a person or a series of people who were immunocompromised.
That seems to be the leading hypothesis. We certainly don't have data. We haven't found that individual. And we don't have sort of the genetic sleuthery to trace it back exactly to that. But if you look at the number of mutations, that's the most sort of likely theory to why this type of evolution could occur.
And this new strain first emerged in September, maybe, and it seemingly has spread all over southern England and throughout London very quickly. It seems that most new cases are this strain.
The way the epidemiological data work is that you basically quantify how much of the viral transmission, how many new cases come from the variant, the new strain, or the typical, what we would call a wild-type virus. And the pattern that they saw is that this variant seems to spread through the population quite rapidly. And this certainly is raising everyone's alarm bells.
Okay. And at this point, especially in this country, we don't know how long it's been here or how much it's spreading.
That's right. So we really don't have a good idea of how much of it is here. We think, based on some very preliminary studies, that it's not super duper widespread. It is, of course, worrying that the individuals found to have this variant have no history of travel to the UK. We are not sequencing enough viruses, right? This was found by an incredible work in the UK to say we need to take 5% or 10% of the people who test positive for SARS-CoV-2 and sequence every letter in the genome of that virus and to try to look for exactly this type of thing. Some analysis that the science advocacy group I work with and I have been doing shows that only a couple of states in 2020 even have 1% or 2% of their cases sequenced. Many states have none, and many states where there's tons and tons of transmission has very sparse sequencing. So we would not be finding this if it were here. It is here, and we don't really know how widespread it is. I find it really, as a virologist, this type of evolution is both terrifying and interesting, but what it means for people is not anything new. We need to stop transmitting this virus because this virus might be more transmissible, and that could actually lead to a really horrific outcome in terms of the number of deaths. Some sort of back of the envelope math show that a virus that's more transmissible will actually cause more deaths than a virus that's more deadly because it's exponential the way it spreads.
Oh, wow.
So it's
potentially very bad news. If it's more transmissible.
If preliminary data on transmissibility hold up and we are slow at vaccine rollout and we don't get better at non-pharmaceutical interventions like wearing masks, we could be in for a world of hurt. You know, I think fundamentally we need to be doing the same things that we should have been doing all along, and we need really fast vaccine rollout. Right. So if this thing is more transmissible, but the vaccine still works, and we really hope and think that it likely still will, the faster we get the vaccine to people, the more we can start turning down the transmission, even of a more infectious virus. The good news, and this is data we've had already since the spring, is that vaccination tends to produce a more consistent and robust immune response than does disease. So that is really good news. Are you still going to be protected against this new variant? We have no reason to believe that you won't, so we think so. I would say the other good news about the vaccines, the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, as you know, are mRNA vaccines, which means that we can actually just take the mRNA that we put in the vaccine and give it the new version of the spike protein from the new virus.
That could happen very quickly.
Right. So if we find that the virus has escaped the vaccine, we could swap that in quickly.
Right. This conversation will continue just in terms of how much mask wearing, social distancing, and other measures will be necessary for everyone until really we get to about 75% of the population vaccinated. Do you agree with that?
I would say even then. I think COVID is going to be with us for a very long time. It might take more than a year to get to 75%. COVID tests and COVID diagnoses, I think, will happen occasionally even when we get to 75%, because you will never have 100% of people vaccinated. You'll always have travel around the globe. We see from history that we don't eradicate infectious diseases with vaccines very well. It's only ever happened with smallpox. Only. Right? And so I think that history tells us that both the vaccine will make things immeasurably better. I cannot wait to be vaccinated. Does that mean I won't ever think about COVID risk diagnosis wearing masks? No, I still will even then.
I am curious what kind of faith you have that people will keep up social distancing once they start hearing more and more people they know have been vaccinated.
I don't think we have done well communicating to people how to manage risk. You know, I'm a queer scientist. I was born in 1983, the year HIV was identified as the virus that causes AIDS. Risk management has been a part of my upbringing and culture since I was a child. And I don't think we've done well to communicate how exhausting that is to people, but how much that type of thinking saves lives. It was not a joy growing up to worry about HIV every time I had sex and to feel like if I don't wear a condom, I might die. And yet that was part of how we cared for each other. It's not fun, but it is a way to care.
Well, it was wonderful speaking with you, Joe. Thank you so much. And good luck with all your work.
I feel more energized now than when we started the conversation. So I think that's a marker that it's done something for me. Thank you so much.
Same. Thank you.
Joseph Osmundson is a molecular biologist at New York University. He spoke with staff writer Carolyn Cormon. Stick around. We're going to change things up in a moment. This is the New Yorker Radio Hour.
Yeah, well, this mad world made me crazy. Might just turn around to 180. I ain't politicking, I ain't kissing no baby. It's the devil on my doorstep being so shady. Don't trip. We don't gotta let him in. Don't trip. Yeah, yeah. I let it go, but I never go with.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick.
Hello, David. How are you?
Good. What are you writing this week?
What am I writing this week? That's a good question. Something, hopefully.
Sheldon Pierce joined us just a few months ago as music editor and writer for the New Yorker's Goings On About Town section. And one of these days, and I hope it's this year, I'll get to drop by his desk and actually meet Sheldon in person. But for now, Zoom has got to do. Sheldon, how are you?
I'm doing all right, pressing forward as best I can.
as we all are.
All the uncertainty.
I imagine you in a small room listening to music 14 hours a day. Am I kind of getting it right?
Yeah, a lot. Sometimes more than that.
And right now you're listening to posthumous rap albums. What's that all about?
Yeah, so every genre sort of has recordings that come after the artist has passed. The Prince estate has been releasing a ton of music since he passed. A lot of it reissues, a lot of it sort of live outtakes. But rap is specifically different from other genres in that a lot of these artists are young artists who pass in their primes and then leave a lot of music behind. The phenomenon sort of started in the late 90s, early aughts, with rappers like Notorious B.I.G., Tupac, Eazy-E, Big Pun. But recently, in the past 16, 18 months, we've sort of seen a boom in posthumous rap albums. Sadly, a lot of rappers have died in shooting incidents, in drug overdose related incidents. And what we're seeing in these specific incidents is rappers now they can record wherever they are. They have a setup in their house. They have a setup in their tour bus. They have a setup in their hotel room. It is easier now than ever to record music. And so they are recording hundreds and often thousands of songs. And so when these young rappers are dying, they are leaving behind massive catalogs.
Just to be clear, so if you are a rapper, you're able to do this sitting, you know, in your kitchen with
Absolutely.
A microphone and something coming through your headphones. Now, are these tracks that are formed after they're gone? Are the beats laid on after sometimes? How is it all done technically?
So this is fascinating, and I want to start, get into one of our picks, Mac Miller's Blue World from his posthumous album Circles.
It's a blue world, alone.
Yeah, well, this mad world made me crazy. Might just turn around to 180.
So, Mac Miller, largely independent rapper, died in 2018. He was sort of just on the cusp of figuring out who he was musically when he passed.
Sheldon, one of the mysteries of these records is not only what makes a good posthumous song, but who gets to decide this business of the central creative intelligence being missing, having the music being controlled by executors, lawyers, producers. It must be quite a drama.
Yeah, so one thing that we see is typically it starts with how these people want the artist to be perceived in the long term. And in a lot of cases, the best of these albums are decided by people who were close to the artist, who are putting the artist's interest first, but mostly are coming together as a tribe and deciding these things together. In the case of the Mac Miller album Circles, there were many different people in the room. John Bryan, who was his key collaborator, his engineer, Vic Weinstein, his manager, Christian Clancy, and his publicist, Nick Deal, all put their heads together and were trying to decide what was the best for this music. And they bumped heads a lot.
What else have you been listening to, Sheldon?
I've also been listening to the music of the emo rapper Lil Peep. Emo rap is sort of a weird and controversial distinction, and Lil Peep was among the most controversial figures of this movement.
Why was he so controversial?
There are emo fans who don't think that he's emo, and there are rap fans that don't think he's a rapper because he is blurring these lines, and perhaps that speaks to how innovative the stuff that he was working on was. I want to get into the song When I Lie, which sort of speaks to how difficult it can be to create some of these posthumous records and the process that you must go through.
Many men have tried to save her, but all they do is try. Woke up on a lonely day, she can't help but wonder why. I saw it on her face, she wanna make those cry. She ends up in a better place in time when she get high.
So you just listening, you can get a sense for the kind of music that Peep makes. It's raw, it's woozy, it's repetitive, and a lot of his songs sound unfinished, and that is the way that he likes them. He likes that rawness to sort of stand in for emotionality. And so Peep died in 2017, and two posthumous albums have been released since, but I had a conversation with Pete's mother, Liza Womack, about how she really had to fight to become the acting administrator of his estate and ensure that his wishes were met. So in the process of the album getting made, one of the albums getting made, she kept hearing about how wonderful things were going and about this great Ty Dolla $ign feature that was added to this song, When I Lie. And she thought it sounded great until she went through Peep's old files and heard the original and realized that they had taken out half the song. So It was at that point that she decided to be more involved and help curate the compilation that this version, the original version, comes from. So you see a little bit about how these projects can create controversy without their creators to make creative decisions for them, because who gets to decide what creative decisions are made in the aftermath and what music is released to which audience?
Now, I think your third choice is one of the saddest events of the, I guess, the pre-COVID part of the year. In February, Pop Smoke, who was a huge figure in Brooklyn with drill music, I guess.
Yeah.
And he was killed in a home break-in. People broke into his house and shot him to death.
And Pop Smoke is a particularly sad case because it seemed like he was at the forefront of this larger Brooklyn movement that was just sort of pushing out and making a statement nationally.
Said I'm never like, you know, it's special packing with the automatics. We gonna send him to heaven.
Drill is sort of this hard-hitting, dark music about sort of street violence in particular and living through it and navigating it. It originates in Chicago, but the kids in Brooklyn sort of made it their own.
She like the way that I dance. She like the way that I move. She like the way that I rock. She like the way that I woo.
And he was the rising tide raising all ships, if you will.
What has been his recorded legacy in the months since?
So after Pop Smoke died, the rapper and Pop Smoke mentor, 50 Cent, executive produced his posthumous album, Shoot for the Stars, Aim for the Moon. And he told Pop Smoke's mom that he'd make the album so successful that he'd get her to award shows. But that is obviously a very different thing than saying that he'd make the best possible album. So the album in turn sort of embraced pop rap from across the country and stuffed unfinished songs with some of the biggest contemporary rappers and has been entirely different from the drill music that sort of made his name.
Do you ever worry that kind of extraneous stuff, junk, is going to get put out and it's going to diminish the reputation or diminish the legacy of a particular artist?
Absolutely. Every single posthumous album runs the risk of doing this. And I think the Pop Smoke album is a good example of this. It is so far removed from the stuff that he made his name on, the stuff that he was best at. But on the other hand, you see this situation where the music that was on the album reached its intended audience. And in the end, Pop Smoke ended up becoming bigger in death than he ever was in life in terms of a national audience, in terms of his songs being huge, and in terms of his album going number one in the country. So at the end of the day, even though critics like myself might say that this album is not Pop Smoke's best work, the music found its audience in the end. So who are we to say that it shouldn't have been released?
Got that big Birkin bag worth 5-6 figures. You might be out your league. Can you buy that? I pull up on the top, going on the thorn. I'm the thorn. You can fuck around if you want. If you want out in Bali, big swing, big dress, big make a big mess. Before we done, she asked, what we going to do it next? Next, so what if the seats in the jet? She like all that gangsta.
You can read Sheldon Pierce on music of all kinds at NewYorker.com. And that's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. Thanks for joining us. I hope you'll join us next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botine, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kala Leah, David Krasnow, Caroline Lester, Gofen Mputubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, and Stephen Valentino, with help from Allison McAdam, Mengfei Chen, and Emily Mann.
With additional help from Kyle Lawrence.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.